Welcome to another edition of Turned Out of Punk. I'm your host, Damien Abraham, and once again, I am bringing you a conversation with someone who grew up listening to punk, may or may not still be involved in punk, but had their life changed by the genre in a major way. And today on the show, not one, but two guests. And don't worry, it's not going to be awkward. We're having to jump through two timelines and two different places. No, because these two guys grew up together. Today on the show, from the extremes, and more importantly, Youth Brigade and BYO fame, and Another State of Mind fame, and tons of stuff. Oh my gosh, we connect some dots on this episode. Mark and Sean Stern are on the show today. This is, of course, for Punk Rock Bowling. We're going to have a lot of fun stuff coming up this week for Punk Rock Bowling, but more on all that in a second. But first, if you would like to get in touch with me, you can head over to the email address, turnoutofpunkpodcast@gmail.com. There's also a Facebook page, facebook.com/turnoutofpunk, run by my brother, both of those things. Tristan Abraham, he's the show producer. You can write to him. He'll get the messages to me. You can also find me on my own social media at Left4Damien. The best way to support the show is by telling all your friends, telling everyone you know about this podcast, or subscribing to it and writing a review and rating it on your podcast listening to platform of choice. But speaking of support, this show would not be possible without the kind, loving support of the fine folks, my friends, my good buddies at Vans and House of Vans. And House of Vans is back in Chicago. And my gosh, is it going to be an amazing summer. Well, it's also back in Vancouver. I'm going to be in Vancouver for a House of Vans event coming up also in the near future. I will have more details on that as I get them. But House of Vans is going to be back in Chicago this summer with an insane, like, unbelievable lineup. Starting off with Vince Staples, then The Breeders, Julian Baker, Banks, Taking Back Sunday, Anderson .Paak, The Rapture, special guests. I'm very excited to see who that special guest is. And then Converge. They're all going to be doing these curated parties at the House of Vans in Chicago. If you've never been to one of these parties, they're incredible. It's like a free, amazing show. Like, I'm going to say the best shows I've ever seen by some of these bands were at House of Vans events. And I'm not just saying that because they sponsor this podcast. I'm being 100% legitimate. I was talking to my brother about this the other day. I saw Cap'n Jazz at the House of Vans last summer, and it was one of the best shows I've ever seen in my life. In my life. And so friends of the show, Julian Baker and Converge, and hopefully, you know, I'd love to interview Taking Back Sunday for this podcast at some point. The Breeders. I'm hoping they're going to fly me out to some of these. They should. I'm really hoping. But we will find out. Oh, my gosh. It's going to be a good summer. So House of Vans is back. Thank you, Vans, for supporting this podcast and letting me book whoever I want on this thing. Because I can just have whoever I want. Speaking of things that are coming up, I'm really excited about this thing coming up. We're going to be talking about, well, I guess we've got to talk about it because they're on the show this week. But the institution, Punk Rock Bowling, is returning to Las Vegas. This is coming up next weekend. If you're listening to this podcast when it comes out, the weekend of like May 24th. Was that the May 2-4 weekend, I guess you would call that? Yeah, you'd probably call that May 2-4 weekend. That's what we call it in Canada. But I don't know, you can call it whatever you want. But this is coming up. This is going to be a huge event in Las Vegas. There's going to be tons of sideshows, tons of bands playing. Rancid, Flag, Descendants, Refused, Specials. Like, you can just go on. Killing Joke. The bands that are playing the sideshow sideshows are ridiculous as well. It is incredible. It's like punk rock takes over the city of Las Vegas. And my good friend Vanessa, who is a publicist at Fat Records, or publicist at Fat Records, and she also works at Punk Rock Bowl, and she hit me up and she's like, you know, I want to get you a bunch of cool guests for the show. And I was like looking at the schedule because we have so many guests kind of lined up and already recorded. And I'm like, you know what? Let's just blow it out. Let's just do one crazy little chunk of shows. So there's going to be, for the next few days on Turned Out of Punk, a punk rock bowling marathon. So thank you to Vanessa for working hard and kind of putting this together. But we've got, I'm going to say right now, I haven't done one of these last interviews. It's going to come under the wire. I'm going to say let's just say two for now. Two amazing, incredible episodes. I'm going to reveal the next one at the end of this show. But we're starting off with the band Youth Brigade, the people that put on Punk Rock Bowling each and every year, but also a band, as you will hear in this podcast, that I don't really think gets the credit they deserve for kind of kickstarting hardcore in, at least a part of hardcore, certainly a DIY part of hardcore. This is illustrated in that, landmark documentary, the foundational canon documentary, Another State of Mind, where you see their tour across, I guess most of North America. They don't go to Mexico, but they try and do most of North America. And you've got to see that. If you've not seen this documentary, you have to see this documentary. But like you'll hear in this one, we get into some awesome stuff. Like, you know, I never thought when I first sat down and thought about doing a Youth Brigade interview that I would be talking about Escarbuto and Zau with them. But that's the way it goes here at Turned Out of Punks. Speaking of going, before I let you go, I got to reiterate that finally, The Wrestlers, the TV show that I put my blood, sweat, and tears into for the better part of half a decade at least. Also, the blood, sweat, and tears of the fine folks at Salazar, this incredible Nathan and Jeff team, and Yuji, and Colin, and Grady, and Sarah, who, my gosh, when you see some of the episodes that she found and put together that I had no idea about in wrestling, it's going to blow your minds. There's just so many people that worked on this over the years, like countless. I could go on forever about that. But I got to say, without these people, none of this would be happening, but it is finally happening. Thanks also Dark Side of the Ring. So directly after Dark Side of the Ring on 10 p.m. on Wednesday, starting next week, next Wednesday, set your DVRs now or make plans now to have a screening party, invite all your friends. And then if you report ratings, say there were like 25 more people in there than there were, just add an extra, it's wrestling tradition to inflate the numbers, right? Exactly. But you got to see this thing. I'm so proud of it. So happy. Next week, it is going to be premiering. The first episode is about Evolve Wrestling featuring Darby Allin. More on that next week on the show. Actually, Darby Allin will be a guest, advanced spoiler on that one. And it's an incredible episode. Wait till you see this guy in this documentary. Oh my gosh. He is a class unto himself in pro wrestling. Also featuring the music of Neurosis. It is, something to behold. That is next week on Viceland. So I'm not going to blather on anymore. I'm going to let you sit back, relax, and enjoy Sean and Mark Stern from Youth Brigade and the Extremes, good underrated band, as we talk about a lot on this podcast, on Turned Out a Punk. Mark, Sean, thank you both for coming on the show.
Hey, thanks for having us.
Yeah, happy to be here.
Well, as I was just telling you off air, it is a huge honor to have you on the show because, it's only when I kind of flip through my record collection that I realize that Youth Brigade and yourselves, obviously, are the link between so many disparate international punk scenes. And that's the bread and butter of this show. So, oh my gosh, is it going to get nerdy? But before we get to that, I got to start it off the way I start them all off, which is, how did you get into punk? And I guess whichever one of you got into punk first, maybe, I don't know how this is going to work, but I would love to hear how it happened.
Well, Sean's a year older. So even though we probably got into it about the same time, I guess he was a couple days earlier.
Yeah. I mean, it was the summer of 77. And so the big paper in town, the LA Times, the big rock critic, Robert Hilburn, he wrote an article about the punk rock and the Pistols, and the Pistols were touring or about to tour the States. And I read that. And then on the local rock radio, which at the time was KMET, they played late night on one of these shows where they played, the whole album of a new artist. They played Elvis Costello's My Aim Is True. Mm-hmm. And I heard that. And that's really got me interested. And, I started reading about it. We had already started a band. We've been playing music for a while. And, Yeah, I mean, that was sort of the beginning of it. And then the first show we went to was a few months, probably 6 months later, we went to see...
the Dickies.
We went to see the Dickies at the Whiskey.
Oh, what
an Well, so backtrack. So we had a band in high school, so and started listening to Sex Pistols and stuff like that. We changed our sound and started writing songs, or was that after the Dickies show?
No, that was then, yeah.
It was around then, because it was me, Sean, and this other guy from school. You know, we were surfers and had long hair. And we went to the Dickie show, and our bass player, he kind of freaked out. He left, I think.
Yeah.
He couldn't deal with it. It was the weirdest thing. We were just at the Whiskey last week for Cokie the Clown. And I was telling Mike this story. And it was Mike's first place to see a show. But that, he was later. His was like Subhumans. But this was 78, 77.
78. It was 78. Spring of 78, because the Dickies were about to get signed, so we had heard about them. We didn't really know much about them. I was at probably 17, you were probably 16, and we went down to the show, and we didn't really have tickets, and we didn't know. We were sort of hanging around the back, and there was this bouncer guy. He looked like Lurch from the Munsters, and actually I think people called him Lurch, and he looked at us, and he's like, "Oh, you guys want to get in?" And he's like, "Give me $5 each and I'll let you in through the back door." I don't know why. I mean, I think there were still tickets for sale. But we went inside, and this guy, Richard Melzer, who was a rock critic out of Seattle, I guess. Yeah, he had a band called Vom.
Yeah, great band. Absolutely.
Oh, no, they weren't great that night.
Electrocute My Cock is a classic.
Well, yeah, maybe, but, you know, this is the first punk thing we ever saw. We're 16, 17 years old. And we went upstairs. They still had some seats up there. And we were sitting there waiting for the band to come on. And they come on, and they're fucking terrible. They can barely play. Because his thing was, oh, punk rock, anybody can play it. Which, yes, it's true. Anybody can do it. That was the beauty of punk rock. But that doesn't mean you're any good. Yeah. And they were not good. They were, you know, 35, 40-year-old men up there playing, and they were really bad. And then at the end of their set, first of all, there was barely anybody watching them. Maybe 20 people on the floor. It was dead. And at the end of their set, this woman
– there was two of them.
Was there two?
Yeah,
I don't remember one.
Dressed as, like, French prostitutes. They were dancing to the song, and then they just pulled – Well, the one did. She just pulled a bloody tampon out.
Out of her pussy.
Out of her pussy and started eating it. And we were like, what the fuck is that?
And that's when the two friends, it wasn't Scott, our bass player, but it was two other friends, because we were big stoners in high school, but two of our stoner friends came and they said, that's it, we're out of here. And they left. Or I think they left. I think they said, we're out of here. And we said, no, wait for the Dickies. And then when the Dickies went on, a whole crowd of people came in, because basically what the Dickies did was they told everybody at the Canterbury, which was the hangout up in Hollywood, they said, come on down to our show, we'll put you on our list, because the A&M scouts, A&M's A&R people were coming down to look at, to sort of see them play, because they wanted to sign them, which they eventually did. But yeah, so Dickies come on, place fills up, and they just go, they just blew us away. We all just sat there with our mouths wide open going, this is amazing. And that was... It was pretty much then that I said, that's it, man. I don't want to do covers. Because before in our high school band, we were mostly doing covers. We were into Jimi Hendrix and, you know, Aerosmith and Led Zeppelin and all the 70s punk rock bands, because that's what we listened to. That's what we grew up with. Mm-hmm. And after we saw that, I said, fuck it. We're just going to write
our songs. But the good 70s rock bands is what we were into.
Well, the shitty 70s rock bands came later. You're talking like Foreigner and Journey and all that stuff.
Sucks.
Yeah. And then, So that was the Dickie show. That's what really inspired us to start writing our own stuff. And that's when our band, it was called Mess. We started playing our own stuff, and we mostly just played parties. And then in that summer, we went up to Hollywood, and that's when we met some of the people up there that are actually in the punk scene. Mm-hmm. And started hanging out there, and then we started. That's when we formed the Extremes.
So I guess, like, what was it that prior to that, when you're listening to this sort of the 70s rock stuff, were you aware of like the Stooges and the MC5 stuff? Or was this like completely a new world opening for you?
It was a completely new world. I mean,
we heard MC5 and stuff.
Well, you'd hear the glam stuff and the David Bowie stuff because, you know, Rodney Bingenheimer had that club. But when that stuff was coming out, we were, you know, 12, 13, 14 years old. So, we weren't really going out. We were just starting to go out to shows. I think the first show we went to, we were 14, 15. We went to Robin Trower.
We went back to Toronto and we went and saw the Beatles.
Well, yeah, that was in 78.
Yeah.
Really?
So after the Dickie.
Yeah, we went up to visit family in Toronto, and that was so I think it was summer of 78 when Devo's Are We Not Men came out, and we really loved that record. And the B-52's 7-inch with Rock Lobster had come out, and we were in Toronto, and it just so happened they were playing at the Horseshoe.
With the B-People, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, so what a sick show.
Yeah, yeah. So we went up there, and we just said, yeah, we're from L.A., and I don't know what it was, but somehow the guy at the door thought, we said, we're in this band from L.A., and he thought we were somebody else. I don't know. But they let us in for free. And, it was pretty awesome.
And that opened up a whole new world to us, getting into free shows.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we never paid for a show ever since now.
That's why you got to start a band, right? You're like, I got to stop paying for these shows.
Oh, yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. It's the only perk. Yeah.
So was that the only show you got a chance to see when you were in Toronto on that trip?
Yeah, there wasn't.
Yeah, there wasn't like a scene much yet. It was just starting.
I mean, I'm sure there was somewhat of a scene, but it was pretty small. And it wasn't as if there was a bunch of punk people. It was funny because when we were touring early on in Canada, some of the smaller cities, like in Saskatoon, remember?
Mm-hmm.
They all. It was some college that we played in, and they colored their hair, everybody that came. I mean, it wasn't a lot of people. Was on that social.
It was like temporary dye. Yeah.
And so they were sweating and the dye was just rolling down their face.
Because it was Vice Squad, us, and Social Distortion.
Yeah. Oh. Now we're getting way ahead of ourselves.
Yeah, we're jumping way ahead. But I think that's like, and we're definitely, I want to cover that, obviously, that tour extensively, because that is really like, you guys were bringing hardcore to all these places, like pre-internet, where I'm sure like the only relationship they had to this music was like the odd thing they were picking up.
Yeah, fanzines, postcards.
Yeah.
Yeah, using the U.S. and Canadian Postal Service around the world, and that's how everybody communicated. And when I was booking the Another State of Mind tour, it was basically, we don't know people in a lot of these towns, so I would just call the local college radio station or find a record store in the Yellow Pages. Yes, we still use the Yellow Pages then. And then I'd just say, hey, we're in this band and we're coming up from L.A. Sometimes they knew who we were. A lot of times they had no idea. But most of the people were pretty cool and they helped hook us up. And that was just how the DIY scene sort of got going. I mean, we did it. Discord people did it. Touch and Go people did it. You know, even the... Yeah, DOA did it, SST people did it, everybody, that's what you did, you know, and everybody would sort of exchange numbers and contacts, and sometimes people were around for years, and sometimes they were flash in the pan, and they were gone after 6 months, but that was the fun stuff. It was all an adventure.
Well, it's amazing, too, because, like, you know, obviously Another State of Mind is like, the document that is, like, timeless, because it's still the shows and the experiences that you guys have are still had by DIY bands to this day. Like, it's amazing how, you know, like that you guys could have put it out last year and it would be believable. Minus the lack of cell phones, I guess.
Yeah.
Cell phones and internet and but people, I mean, making music, rock band, and
it'd be a lot easier to make the movie now.
Yeah.
With cell phone.
there wouldn't be reels of lost footage at this point.
Yeah,
exactly. We had a whole truck with a crew, you know.
But
it was three person crew,
but still.
What was it? I just jumping back in time. What were the kind of like differences you noticed between what you had seen in LA and that sort of early punk scene versus what you were seeing in you know, Toronto at that first punk show?
I mean, well, hard to say, because in LA there was a that Generation X song, 100 Punks Rule.
Yeah.
That's pretty much like Hollywood was. There was 100 punks. They all lived in a building called Canterbury. Through the alley at the Pussycat Theater was a mask. So everybody lived in the building. Everyone in the building was in a band. And all the bands played a block away at the mask. So that was pretty much what you would do. You'd be at the building. everyone would practice in the basement, and then, oh, so-and-so's playing at the Mask, and then everybody from the building would then go to the Mask
and pay admission. Yeah, would walk half a block down the street and
pay a buck or whatever.
And then, just so you probably don't know, the Pussycat Theater was a porn theater. It was a bit of a chain in the 70s, and the Mask was pretty much the first underground punk club. It was run by this guy, Brendan Mullen, this Irish guy who moved out here and became a pretty good... I mean, he was one of the sort of trailblazing promoters who was in the punk scene. He played in a few different bands as well. He was a good drummer. And the Mask was in the basement of that Pussycat Theater.
Yeah, I went actually a couple years ago to L.A. and we kind of somehow talked the janitor into letting us get into the building so we could go down and see where the Mask was. Because there's still the graffiti on the wall, at least a couple years ago.
So, I mean. That's how Hollywood was. And so Toronto, I mean, if there was something like that, we weren't, you know, we didn't know about it.
I don't think there was. But, you know, we were just, we were two teenage kids who just happened to be visiting our family and saw, hey, look, B-52s are playing. Let's go. We knew Rock Lobster. We had the 7-inch. And it was awesome. We somehow managed to worm our way in for free. It was a great show. But I can't say that I saw some burgeoning, you know, punk scene in Toronto in 1978. I'm sure there was there were some bands. What's the band who did the Red Rubber Ball? I mean, I think
the Demics. There is like the Diodes, the Demics, sort of the Diodes, the Red Rubber Ball.
Yeah, they probably existed then, but we didn't know. I mean, you know, we were 78. I was probably 18. I just turned 18. You just turned 17. So.
I guess jumping back to when you in LA and you're starting the Extremes, what was the scene like that band fit into? Because it's like very much a minimal synth band. And I love that single. I think that single is super underrated.
That's because nobody's heard it.
Yeah.
we buried that sucker.
But you have to understand that the punk scene in those days was very diverse. You know,
yeah, absolutely.
One of the biggest bands in LA punk scene was the Screamers.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Got a singer, this guy to sing with us who lived at the Canterbury, basically so that we could be in, you know, get into that punk scene there.
We were among a handful of, you know, teenagers that were in the scene. That scene, that original scene, was mostly people in their mid-20s all the way up to their 40s. It was very arty, and most of the people involved were, you know, looking at England and looking at New York, and that was they were aspiring to be bands like that, but also to get a deal with a major label. So we were there, but, you know, we kept saying for a long time, wait till all the surfers and skaters get into punk rock, then it's just going to explode. Those people didn't really care so much about that. They just wanted to get A&R people down to see them. You know, the Dickies were the first band to get signed out of that scene.
Well, going back to the Extremes, though, that's what we're talking about is, you know, the Extremes were pretty much, you know, in that realm. Voodoo, Wall of Voodoo came out of that.
That came later.
Came a little later.
Nervous Gender was another sort of. Yeah,
so there was a lot of kind of synth bands, and we would play, you know, the Extremes were playing with X, the Bags, the Go-Go's, you know, all those bands. The Weirdos.
The Go-Go's were a punk band when they started. They used to rehearse. We were friends with them, and they used to rehearse in the same space. Because bands would rehearse in the Mask as well, in the daytime, as well as at the Canterbury in the basement there. But the Germs rehearsed there, the Bags, the Weirdos, the Skulls, everybody. You know? F-Word, remember them?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And it's always talked about, like, you know, like what you're referring to is this sort of dividing line that happened, and it's the way it's kind of talked about, at least in a lot of the documentaries and a lot of the books, is that there was this kind of cool, arty, inclusive scene, and then this giant surf punk suburb scene came in and squashed it. Is that what you guys saw, or is that just like a misreading?
That's sour grapes, I think, on the older people from my perspective. Because remember, we were part of that surf, that crazy surf scene. We embraced that scene because before that, it was just these arty farty people. And then, you know, you have to also remember at the time, punk rock, to walk down the street with a mohawk or colored hair or whatever, you got a lot of abuse from hippies and jocks and stuff. Yeah. So when everybody started cutting their hair and getting into punk rock, that abuse started, the table started turning, you know, people. So that early art scene,
people gave you shit. Yeah. You could turn around and beat the shit out of them.
So, yeah, I mean, I think the perfect example of what you're talking about was X talking about it in The Decline of Western Civilization.
Well, and in that new documentary, Punks, too.
Yeah, like
it's, yeah, I didn't see, did you watch it.
No, I watched a little bit of it.
Yeah, I did. We went to the screening, but it was just little snippets from each episode. But I did watch the third one, which is kind of LA, because that one was still on YouTube. I guess MGM pulled them all off.
Oh, they did.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I watched that part, and the people were pretty much after 1980. You know, pretty much the punk scene was dead.
But you know, that's the thing is. But my contention is that most of those people, all they really wanted to do was get signed to a major label and have a career. And I mean, X and the Dickies did it, and then most of the other bands didn't, and they broke up. Whereas the bands that got together when that scene exploded, you know, that's when we started Youth Brigade. That's when we started running Godzillas. That's when we were putting on Youth Movement 82 and 83 and promoting shows and started the label and stuff. So those people, as much as I love them all, they're all great people, and believe me, they were huge influences on us. The bands, all those bands.
They were all pioneers.
Yeah, they were pioneers, but they kind of gave up. I mean, I understand that they're saying we were alienated, it got violent. Yeah, it did, but there was a lot of frustration out there, and that's the way it got dealt with. I mean, I'm not going to justify some of the violence, but some of it was just, that was what drew me to punk rock in the first place. And the words that I write are of the frustration of the, basically the failure of the hippies, who basically said, you know, we want to fight against the war. We want to fight against all these different causes. But for me, those problems didn't go away. Those guys just gave up. That to me was what punk rock was about. It was a reaction to the fact that those problems still existed, and music should reflect that. And punk rock still does. Rock and roll, not so much.
Yeah, no, I think it's interesting to hear from people that were there, like you're saying, that have, you know, another perspective on it, because the way the history is written, it's like people ignore the fact that, no, like, after punk died and hardcore gets going, that's when it becomes something international. That's when it becomes something that's kind of revolutionary.
Mm-hmm. And that's when it became also more of a international scene, I guess. You know, that's before it was, you know, kind of constricted to each town. Everybody was just out for themselves. I mean, even when you look at the English bands, I mean, most of the English bands were just trying to get, they're all on major labels.
Yeah.
It's all your favorite English bands. Hey, if I could make money off playing music and get signed to a label, you know, and all of them lost all the rights to all their music, you know, where in the States, that's what's funny about people talking about, you know, that's the where punk was, you know, the biggest, it was born there. It's like LA has always had the biggest punk scene, you know.
Put it this way, New York Dolls and Iggy Pop, they're considered the fathers really of punk rock, even though everybody looks at the Pistols and the English scene and the Clash and all those bands who we loved. But, you know, they all followed the model of what rock and roll had become, which was you start a band, you get a buzz, you sign to a major label, and then you become, you know, that becomes their career. And that's what the people in LA were trying to do. They were looking to New York, they were looking to London, and that's what they were trying to do. They were trying to follow that model because that's all they knew. A few people started little independent labels, but it was few and far between. And it wasn't until the scene blew up. You know, me personally, it's all punk rock. The whole term of hardcore, I think, was coined by Tim Yohannan at Maximum Rock and Roll. I don't really delineate a difference between punk rock and hardcore. To me, hardcore is a sort of subset of punk rock, but whatever. That's semantics. I don't really care. The fact of the matter is the DIY scene that we were a part of creating, and by no means were we the only ones. It happened in towns all around the world, first mostly in the U.S., I mean, between what we were doing here, what SST was doing, what Alternative Tentacles up in San Francisco, there were some smaller labels here and up there, then Discord in D.C., There was some stuff in New York. There was the guys up in Boston. There was Touch and Go in Detroit. There's probably some others that I'm not thinking about right now. But that scene was started by younger people who didn't care about signing to a major label. We knew that major labels weren't interested in us, and we weren't interested in working with them because we saw early on that you go to a major label, you're going to get co-opted. They're going to tell you what to do. They're going to try and own your music, and we had no interest in that. It was a kind of necessity thing too because they weren't interested in us. We were small time. And that's the way it remained until the 90s. And, you know, then you see what happened when that all changed.
Oh, yeah.
And some of the bands did sign. Bad Religion signed to a major label.
Green Day.
Yeah. Well, Green Day was later. But, I mean, Bad Religion, one of the bands that had their own label, you know, there was a sort of consensus that you could only go so far on an independent. You needed the major. And then they signed to the major. And what happened? The Offspring went fucking platinum, double platinum on Epitaph.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that thing's probably like, you know, almost what, double diamond by this point or something insane. Like it's like even those metrics matter at this point, but it's still like, yeah, it's ridiculous how big it got. But with the extremes, given the sound you guys were playing and given the, you know, different time frame, did you ever have any interest from any other major labels any labels other than, you know, Test Tube Records or any majors?
No, and Test Tube Records wasn't a label. It was just this kid who liked punk rock and liked the band.
And Greg Hudson was like part of it.
Was he?
Oh, really?
Yeah, he helped. Yeah. He it wasn't his thing, but that was his friend. And I know that he was there helping him out, like pressing records and stuff.
They did a Zeros record too, right? I think.
Did they do a Zeros record?
No, I think he only did that one thing.
He might have done a Zero 7-inch.
A 7-inch, maybe, yeah.
Yeah, 7-inch.
He didn't really, I'll tell you what, he didn't really know what he was doing. Not that we did, but I'm the one, we were the ones who called around because we didn't know how to do this stuff. So we just, we just found, I just, again, Yellow Pages, I called some record pressing plants and I just asked them questions. And then, you know, I basically relayed that information to the kid who was going to pay for it. And I mean, basically he paid for it and we helped sort of put the whole thing together. It's just DIY. It's not really that difficult to do. He didn't, you know, he'd never done it. We'd never done it. We sort of all figured it out together. And from that, that's when, you know, we had already learned the information so that we could do our own.
Yeah, well, there when was decided that. Sorry, go on.
There was a label that did, so like Ultravox in the magazine. Elizabeth worked for that.
That was out of England, though, wasn't it?
Yeah, but that, they were interested in doing something with us, but that's when we broke up.
Yeah, I mean, you have to understand, the Extremes didn't start off with a synthesizer in the band. The Extremes started off as a guitar band. When we started... Russell was the bass player, and then, you know, he kept sort of saying, oh, let me play some synthesizer on a song or two. And that's how the synthesizer got into it. And I wasn't really into it. That's why the band – well, I left the band, and they tried to – they continued on for a little while, but
– yeah, well, because I continued with the singer, and then we got another keyboard player.
Well, he was in the guys, band when I was in.
Yeah, we had some of the guys from the Flyboys.
Oh, yeah. Then you had John and what was the other guys?
Tames,
yeah.
Oh, yeah. Some of the Flyboys got in. And so Sean left, and I continued on with these guys. We were doing more like Factory Records kind of sound, you know, Joy Division, Ultravox, Magazine, you know. I was really into all that whole scene.
Mm-hmm. Well, I love that stuff, too.
Yeah, and it kind of burned out. We didn't really have any, you know, we weren't gaining any new followers. So.
Extremes was a, you know, it was a flash in the pan thing that we did. Would we work on it for maybe a year? Maybe you guys went on for another 3 or 4 months. And then what happened was I found this house in Hollywood that we moved into called Skinhead Manor. And that's sort of where Youth Brigade started, and some other bands. No Crisis started there. Didn't the Circle Jerks used to practice in the garage for a little while?
Yeah. Black Flag.
No, Black Flag never. Circle Jerks.
No. Maybe the Jerks, yeah.
Yeah, the Jerks.
Yeah. They would have been beefing, I would imagine, at that point. So it would be, I guess, an awkward situation if they were practicing in the same spot.
Yeah, they weren't, because the Black Flag is in the South Bay, and they rarely left the South Bay. That's where they practiced. That's where they had SSC. That's where it's always been.
Yeah. No crisis. Sorry.
Well, you know what the thing is? Didn't we record the Extreme single with Spot?
Yeah, you did.
Yeah.
Stop watching the basketball game, Mark, and pay attention.
I'm doing both.
Yeah, we recorded the Extreme single.
I'm losing money while I do the interview.
We recorded the Extreme single down in South Bay at, what was it called? Art Spot? Fuck, I can't remember the name of the studio. But anyhow, this guy Spot was an engineer. He worked on a bunch of the SST stuff. And that was the first time we went to the church, which is where they live. It wasn't squatted, but they rented this old church and they lived there.
And also you have and Jenny Lenz took photos in the for the record too, right?
Jenny Lenz, did she? Yeah, maybe. Yeah, probably.
She's credited on the record.
Yeah. Jenny Lenz, yeah, she's a trip.
Yeah, like, it's amazing, like, you know, because it's funny because you obviously Youth Brigade is such a legendary band and so important, but it's funny how Extremes, you know, it's overlooked, but it's such a, like, in the cut punk record, like pre-codification of punk, but in the cut punk record.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's because we were a punk band when we started that, and then all the arty farty people started bringing in stupid synthesizers. I mean, look. I love Magazine. I love those bands, but we weren't those bands, you know?
Yeah.
So, I mean,
what? Come on, Ephemeral Living.
Ephemeral Living's a funny song.
That single, I do love that single, but I will not punish you anymore about it, I promise. So when you get that house, like, was there a shift? Did you have friends that you're like, yeah, guys, we're not down with this. We're part of this thing that was way more youthful and way more energetic. Was there like friends that didn't come along for the ride with you?
Well,
yeah,
remember the beginning.
Was because
so remember
Orange
when we
County
went,
guys.
Yeah, remember when we looked at the house and it was this old lady who owned it and she was living there. You know that old 60s TV show, The Beverly Hillbillies?
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, it kind of looked like so many people. They were living in this fucking, it was this big ass house with, I don't know, what did it have, 9, 10 bedrooms?
Yeah, just totally run down.
Run down.
It should have been condemned.
Yeah. And so we said, all right, well, we'll rent it. What were we paying? Like $900 a month or something?
I think so, yeah.
And we figured, all right, we'll get six people in here and pay the $120 a month or whatever the hell it was. But yeah, they were living in there. They had a hot plate, and you know, it looked like they were gonna light the place on fire any minute. It smelled horrible. They had so many animals, and they tried to say, "Well, you can rent it, but this guy's gonna live here." Well, no, everybody's gotta go. You know, we were only there for a year. So, but when we moved in first, it was me and you and Peter Stewart, who we went to high school with. He's one of the guys that went on Another State of Mind with. He lived there in the beginning.
Yeah, Kevin Hunter.
Kevin Hunter lived there too. What was the band he ended up being in?
Me and those guys were in a band called the Johnnies.
Oh yeah.
And then Kevin went on to do Wire Train.
Yeah, Wire Train. This really wimpy new wave band.
Yeah, a couple of hits.
Yeah, they had a couple.
I don't even know that band.
And then there was that one girl lived there for a minute. But we had people coming in and out. We started people started bailing because it started getting, you know. Basically, the living room, we put a stage in there, so it became this crazy party house. And yeah, so Mark and I were going to more and more punk shows, and the other people were not digging it, and then they started bailing, and we started getting other new people moving in that were more into the punk rock scene and not to the arty sort of new wave scene.
We would just take whoever we could get at that point.
Remember, we put an ad, because when we decided that we wanted to start Youth Brigade, I was taking vocal class. I was going to Santa Monica City College, and I was taking vocal classes there, and I had to sing a song every week. And, you know, I'd have to go in and sit with this woman who I'd get sheet music, and she'd play the piano and accompany me, and I'd have to sing. Everyone in the class had to do it. Most people were doing, you know, standard, boring songs, popular songs of the day. I was looking and finding swing songs, you know, mm-hmm. out of I don't even know where. I was looking at Tex Beneke and all these people. I'd go to the library, I'd find all these old swing albums, and I'd come up with these awesome songs, and the teacher loved it. And so that's when I came up with this idea. Hey, what if we did a band where we took this sort of swingy sound and we took Oi, sort of punk rock and Oi, and we mixed it together. We need, you know, because that was right at the time of this of the two-tone invasion, and Madness was come out, Specials come out, and I'm like, I want to mix all this stuff together. The problem was, you know, so we advertised in the paper and the local paper here at the time for really cheap classified ads, because in those days you still had to pay, was the Recycler. And so we got people coming out to try out for the band who could play horns, and they were mostly kids in high school who were in the, you know, in the high school band, and they could play, but the problem was we couldn't play. We weren't good enough to play that kind of music. Mm-hmm. And that became apparent pretty quick. But I remember we had that one guy, the big transvestite guy, Paul. He moved in. He was the nicest guy. And he did transvestite shows where he would dress up
as an opera singer.
Yeah, he was fuck. That guy was good. And we were practicing one day, and we couldn't really sort of figure it out. He jumped up and got in and he's like, "No, you got to do it like this." And we were all just blown away how good the guy was. But unfortunately, this weird vast array of people there, it just didn't work out because of, you know, we were what, 19, 20 years old, and you know, it gets a little tiring when I sort of had this idea of this kind of commune thing where everybody pitched in and we all went out and got food stamps so we could get food, and we worked shitty little jobs to pay the rent, but a lot of people just wanted to party and take drugs and fuck off, and eventually the whole thing fell apart. And then somehow somebody mysteriously lit the place on fire after we left and burned it down.
Holy. Maybe it was a hot plate.
Yeah, it might have been the hot plate.
Might have been the hot plate. Wow. So what was – did so did that band ever get to the point of being able to record, like that early Youth Brigade incarnation?
No. We eventually –
We did those demos.
Well, what happened was we dumped the horn idea.
Right.
And then we got a couple of our buddies in
to
sing.
With the horns, it was – originally, Youth Brigade was called the Swing Skins Brigade.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, pretty weird name for two Jews. SS. Yeah.
Well, it's also Sean Stern, so, you know.
Three Jews, sorry, Adam.
Yeah.
Adam
is in the band. Nobody, where was the Oi influence coming from? Like, what were the bands you guys were really into that were doing that sound at that point?
Oh, Angelic Upstarts, Cockney Rejects, Sham 69.
Stiff Little Finger,
not really what I consider an Oi band,
nah.
But, you know, we were listening to a lot of
English. But we were also in, like, Madness, we were into,
yeah.
That, so that's Specials, why, that's how the horn thing, we tried to do the horn thing. But.
That's great, because it would have been like, I guess that would have been almost like ska punk, you know, but before anyone else was doing that sound.
Yeah, well, I mean, you could argue that the two-tone sound was kind of ska, although it wasn't... more ska than punk.
Yeah, I meant more like a third wave kind of ska punk, I guess.
Yeah, it could have been, but we weren't at the point where we could play that stuff yet. Mm-hmm. And so then it became more of just a punk band that was definitely Oi influenced, and we got a couple of our friends to sing. So we had me and then these two guys singing, but it was pretty, we made this demo tape, and then it was pretty clear that they sucked too, and they couldn't barely sing, so we had to get rid of them. So we broke the band up, and then we reformed because we just didn't want to kick them out. And then we reformed as a four-piece with our friend Kevin playing guitar.
Yeah, that's when we recorded.
Yeah, that's when we recorded the three songs for another
Someone's going to get
the head kicked in college.
And so, like, was there, because, like, that's, I guess, it, like, it feels like that must have been, like, you know, a different scene than had happened before. Was that comp kind of like you guys acknowledging that there's a new scene coming and all these new bands, or is it just something that naturally happened?
It kind of naturally happened because,
we knew
Aggression.
Well, so. we were promoting shows, though.
Yeah,
the whole time I was doing, like, you know, vets halls, we were renting halls out, we were doing stuff like that, so, you know, all these bands were coming around,
but it was kind of an exciting time because we were meeting bands from all over. Before, like we were talking earlier, before the scene was pretty much Hollywood, even though quite a few of the people came from other areas of Southern California, everybody moved to Hollywood, but once that whole scene sort of faded away, you know, shows started happening at the Vex and then down at Fleetwood in South Bay. And, you know, we were having a lot of problems with the Cubs coming. So we were getting punk was getting banned at the Roxy and the Whiskey and the Starwood. Starwood was doing shows on Tuesdays for a long time, and, you know, it was going back and forth, and then it got to the point where people had to rent out halls, and we started renting out halls to do shows, and then we started Godzillas. So this was all happening around the same time, and we were meeting people. Godzilla's first Skinhead Manor was a great meeting place, and then the summer that we were living at Skinhead Manor was a time when every Tuesday night there was a punk show at Starwood, and so a lot of bands were popping up from different places and playing at Starwood and meeting, and you know that scene was sort of growing. And then when the Manor fell apart, and we met a ton of bands, when the Manor fell apart was when we moved to other places, and then we started Godzillas, and then we met tons, even more bands, and we were booking the bands at the shows, and we were playing with bands at all these different places, and yeah, I mean, it was a new and exciting time, and a lot of those bands that were around from the early days, the Canterbury, the Mass days, they broke up, or just, a few of them still hung out and still played. It wasn't, you know, sort of that ended and this began. It was crossover sort of thing. It took some time, and then it exploded into the point where we were doing shows, and Golden Voice was up in Santa Barbara, and then what happened was we started, when we were doing Godzillas, there a lot of English fans decided they were wanted to come over, and we're talking about the sort of second wave, Antipasti, Cronjan, some of the smaller bands. And we started talking with this New York agent who was the representative, and she started to try and play us off against Golden Voice to bid up the price for the guarantees. And we were friends with Golden Voice because we'd done shows with Gary Tovar, the guy who started Golden Voice, and we just called him up. Mark called him up and said, "Dude, why are we letting these fuckers manipulate us like this? Let's just co-promote and we'll set the price." Because the only way we could afford the prices they were asking is if we raised the door price, and we didn't want to do that because we knew it was going to be, you know, it was going to be a problem for people to be able to afford that, and that wasn't conducive to, you know, pushing the scene, and that's what we were about. We wanted to promote.
Yeah, just to put it in context, like with Godzilla's, it was $5. Every show was $5 unless the band was from overseas, and it was $6.
Okay.
Beers were $1, a burger was $1, fries were $1. And everybody who worked there was our friend. How many people? Like 50, 40 people.
Yeah,
we employed 40 people,
yeah.
All punks, and ran it, you know. Everyone got paid. All the bands got paid more money than they ever got paid at any clubs.
Yeah, and then I was sort of overseeing the security. And my philosophy was, because, you know, it was true, there was some infighting. That was when it was beginning, where people were fighting because, oh, you're from here, I'm from here. And it was a sort of stupid, it wasn't quite the gang mentality that eventually happened, but it was starting a little bit. And my thing was, I'm going to hire people from all these different areas that I know. And that way, chances are, if there's a fight, someone's going to know someone that's in the fight. And it became this sort of peer pressure thing of, what the fuck are you doing fucking up your own scene, you idiot? If you come here, you come here and have a good time. If you start a fight, we're going to throw you out. And you may know the guy that was security, and they were going to jump in the middle and say, stop fighting, or you get thrown out. And it worked pretty well early on. Unfortunately, the club didn't last more than, what was it, 6 months? Not even.
Yeah, like, no, well,
no, it was, I like think we went months. In the fall, and then we were out by after New Year's.
Yeah.
Was it like an idea of trying to do something that was like vertical integration, or is it just like you're seeing holes at the time? Like you're like, okay, we got a club now. Like there's nowhere to put out records. Let's start a label.
Yeah, it was purely necessity, because it was just a matter of, we have a band, we want to play shows. Punk rock is banned at all these places as well. Then we got to put our own shows. DIY was something that we had to do. We had no choice. If we wanted to do a show, we had to put it. We wanted to put out a record, we had to put a record out.
And that's, you know, that's how we ended up, you know, meeting bands, you know, I guess in a few, or, you know, like the second comp we did, and I don't know if I'm getting ahead of myself here, if you want to go in chronological order.
Well, I've got, believe me, that first comp, like that track listing is ridiculous. Like, and it's also cool because, you know, obviously the second comp, it's a lot bigger in scope of where you're picking the bands from, but on that first compilation, it seems like it's, you know, it doesn't go all the way up to San Francisco, I guess, but you get most of like Southern California represented, be it Battalion of Saints,
yeah,
or Bad Religion, Social Distortion, or even, you know, Oxnard's there with Aggression.
Yeah. Well, and that record, though, you were saying, you know, it was just you're just sort of everybody sort of meeting. Yeah, that record was pretty much
We knew Aggression and then talked to them about doing this. We didn't know Battalion of Saints when we went into the studio. Did we even know? It was through Mark Rude, but I don't even remember how it came about. But he was managing them, and he just
we
said,
knew Mark.
Yeah. And Mark said, you got to check these guys out. And we didn't...
We also knew... We knew the Adolescents, too.
Well, we knew the Adolescents. We knew Bad Religion because we played with them. We knew...
No, they're not on it. Still, we knew them.
We knew them, but we didn't. They weren't on it. No, but so, for example, the Joneses and Battalion Saints, we never heard them before they came into the studio to record for that. So we had no idea what was going to happen. And I remember...
With the Joneses was the weird... That was a weird one. I can't remember
That's a weird
who,
one, yeah.
Steve Olsen.
No, I know, but who? I don't know how we ended up getting him in. I think it was like Steve. It was the guys from the Blades. Like, oh, you should check out the Joneses.
Yeah, yeah.
And we needed another band, and so they came up to Hollywood to go in the studio, and we were listening to the tracks, and we were like, man, I don't know if this fits at all. Now, then it became my favorite song on, you know, my favorite songs on the record.
No, but the really
like
weird
classic,
one, the really weird one, like the Blades were our friends because we made friends with a lot of people in Huntington and Adolescence too, and Aggression we made friends with. But the really weird one for me, I mean, the Joneses definitely, but Battalion of Saints, we had no idea what they sounded like. Mark Reed was a friend of ours. He was like, I'm in this band. They're great. You should put them on this compilation. You know, normally we would never do that. But, you know, after that record, it was never sight unseen that we would ever put a record out. But we were putting this compilation out, and we thought, all right, we need some bands. For whatever reason, some of the other bands that we knew couldn't do it. I mean, the Bad Religion track was already done. And I think we didn't record the Adolescent stuff, did we?
No.
Yeah, that was already done as well. But so the Battalion of Saints come up there, and we meet them. And like I said, we'd never heard them before. So they start playing, and George puts a baffle up in the studio because he doesn't want anybody to watch him when he sings.
Okay.
Like, okay, that was weird for us. We'd never seen anything like that. It was kind of weird. Like, what's going on? This is strange. And they go into the song, I'm like, what the fuck? This is insane. And because when he sings, he sings like when he was playing live. He's jumping around like a maniac behind this baffle. So we were just sitting there looking at each other saying, what the fuck? This is insane. So we were pleasantly surprised, put it that way.
Yeah, I can imagine that's a... You know, that makes up for the weirdness of the Joneses is getting that Battalion of Saints in the studio, I guess.
Yeah. But I like the Joneses stuff. I mean, yeah. I think, oh, this is never going to work. It was
pretty different for the record.
But we rolled with the whole thing. I mean, I think it's a really good snapshot of what was going on in the L.A., in the Southern California punk scene. You know, yeah, we didn't get up to some... It was really a Southern California record. It wasn't meant to be anything but that. And, you know, sometimes those things just come together at the time. Just weird. I mean, we didn't...
And sometimes a band records something, and that recording defines their sound for them.
Yep.
And that's what the Battalion of Saints recording did.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, no, that definitely... That compilation still holds up. But so was that compilation, like when that came out, was it, you know, immediately kind of picked up upon? Was it like a success? Because there's like... a ton of pressings of it.
It did really well. We got a ton of attention, like, you know, especially locally with all, you know, the LA Times.
Well, and I'll give you another little nugget for you. Matt Groening from The Simpsons was the music, he was the music editor for the local LA Reader, which no longer exists, but it had come in because there was a Chicago Reader and they started an LA Reader, and it was a competition for the LA Weekly, which at the time was the big local weekly. But he was awesome. I mean, he loved punk rock, and he would call us when we were doing Godzilla's and say, Hey, what's going on? What's going on? What are you guys doing? And I'd start talking and he'd say, Hold on, let me go to my typewriter. And he wrote about what we were doing. He was great. He was very supportive, and he loved that record.
That's
awesome.
He wrote
a few of it. Yeah.
And so, like, by that point, I guess, you know, things are going, right? Like, had you already – you guys hadn't toured, though. Like, I guess it's just Southern California stuff you're doing at this point?
Yeah. I think we've been up to San Francisco. We've been down to San Diego. But, yeah, we hadn't really – I don't even think we'd gone to Phoenix yet. I think that came a little bit later. So, but yeah, that's when we decided. Once that we recorded that, someone got their head kicked in, that came out. We also recorded a Youth Brigade record,
And that's when we had already started coming up with the idea. Well, we'd come up with the idea of doing the tour because we bought the school bus. Mm. And the school bus is in the photo on the back of the Someone Got Their Head Kicked In compilation.
So Sound and Fury, the original version, is recorded the same time?
Right after.
Right after, okay.
At Mistake Studios with Doug Douchebag Moody.
Oh my gosh! I want to ask you so much stuff, but you've said a trigger word here. I turned out a punk. Doug Moody. What was it like working with the infamous Doug Moody?
I'll give him this. He was a wealth of knowledge. He was a good bullshitter and a salesman, but he was a wealth of knowledge, and he did help us out early on, and gave us a lot of stuff to think about and sort of helped out. However, he was also a scammer. Mm-hmm. And, you know, his studio, you know, he's got a million stories. I don't know how many of them were true. I mean, according to him, Led Zeppelin recorded with him maybe more like Led Zeppelin recorded on that board that I had, you know, 20 years earlier or whatever. But he did give us some information that was good, you know, and he said, look, you know, this was the biggest problem. This is the falling out that we had with him. So when we recorded, we ran out of money, and he said, you know, while we were recording and we were talking with him every day, and he said, look, you know, when you're a small label like this, it's really hard to go and get your record sold. It would be smart, because he was just sort of looking at the lay of the land, and he'd been involved in independent records for a while, but he didn't really know much about punk rock. We were the first punk rock band that he'd ever, you know.
And he's like an older guy. He was like 20 years old. You know,
oh, he was in his 40s for sure back then. So he started saying, you know, you go and you want to put these records in the stores, you're going to have a difficult time. You need a distributor. I mean, there's other labels, aren't there? And I said, yeah, there's SSC. He's all, what you need is sort of someone to come in and put together a sort of consortium where these labels all group together, and then you can go to distributors and you've got power, which he's right. I mean, it made sense. However, his thing was, you guys, we should do that. And I said, I don't really want to be the guinea pig for your idea.
Yeah.
But why don't you get it going? And once you get it going, then, you know, if it's working, sure. And he's all, well, I gave you credit and you owe me money. So he kind of sort of extorted us into his little plan. And I said, I tell you what, we'll do that for the he went down to one of the distributors, because independent distributors were just starting to pop up at that point. Mm-hmm. And he went down to Important, I think it was, right?
Yeah.
Important Records, which was out of New York, but they had an open in an L.A. office. And he said, I got this new compilation, and I got this Youth Brigade record. And he made a deal with them, which was basically they would front the money for the pressing of this first pressing. And we were leaving on Another Shade of Mind tour. Okay, he's going to do that. He go, I got an advance that'll pay for the pressing of all this stuff. Great, and then we'll settle up when you get back. We come back. Hey, Doug, all the shit sold out. We want to repress. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Where's the money? We need an accounting. Yeah, yeah, yeah. No problem. I'll get that for you. No accounting's coming. Nothing's really happening. So basically, he bullshitted. He took the money. He spent some of the money, and he also put the name of our record in his name, you know, at the pressing plant, all the parts, everything was under his name. So when we wanted to repress, they were, you need to get permission from Doug Moody. It's all under his name.
Oh.
And he was dicking around. You know, his studio, Mistake, was around the corner from the Café de Grand. So we were at the Café one night with a bunch of the guys from Aggression, and I don't know if you ever saw them. The bass player, Big Bob, he's a big dude. Yeah, they're all friends of ours. So we were at the cafe and we're talking about how this guy's dicking us, and we're drinking and we're like, fuck it, let's go over there. So we go around the corner and we go, hey, Doug, gonna come up and say hi. Oh, yeah, come up, guys. And basically got in his face and said, listen, motherfucker, you need to call the fucking pressing plant and the processing plant and tell them to put the shit in our name.
Oh, tomorrow, we took all the tapes.
Yeah, tomorrow morning. Otherwise, we're going to destroy your studio right now. And he was like, oh, no, no, okay, don't do that. All right. And he did that, and that was pretty much the last time we ever dealt with him. Because he owed us money.
Mm-hmm. We said, where's the advance from all this? We sold 2,000 records. This is how much it costs. Where's the rest of the money? Well, you know, I had to just pay for this and that and blah, blah, blah. And just bullshit. And he owed us about $1,500 by our estimation. And in fact, we took him to small claims court. Mark went to that. What happened with that, Mark?
I didn't go.
Yeah, you did.
What? The Judge Judy thing?
No, they wanted us to go in the people's court. We said,
really? That would have been amazing.
I know. We should have done
that. We should have done that. Because, you know, but I said no because people's court pays both sides. They just pay off and go.
Yeah.
So I'm like, fuck that guy. We have an open and shut case.
I never went to
court. Yeah, you went to court.
No, I
did. Yeah, you did. And you lost.
That's the reason that it was never repressed properly, or was it just that you guys didn't like the recording?
No. The reason that we stopped, we called back when we were on the road, and we said, because we didn't get a chance, it wasn't pressed before we left on tour. Yeah. So we got some shit to us when we were on tour, and we put it on somebody's turntable at somebody's house, and it sounded like shit.
Yeah.
What the fuck? This sucks.
Yeah. Well, in the end, if you listen to anything off of Mystic back then, it all sucks. And I'll attribute it to Mystic, but I also attribute
it's Richard Simpson.
Richard Simpson mastering was one guy in this little room, and everybody mastered with him.
He was very cheap.
Cheap, and it was like this really old equipment, you know, where he cut the lacquers. And when you go back and listen to anything that came out of L.A. at that time that was mastered by Richard.
Yeah, it was not good.
It just sounded like it was inside a pillow.
Yeah. That's just not good. So, so we stopped printing it because we didn't like the sound. We thought it was the mix, but we discovered years later that it was really just Richard's bad mastering.
Plus we were on the road. We had written a bunch of new songs.
Yeah. So then we went back into the studio. We went in with Tom Wilson. We only re-recorded a few songs. I think we were Violence.
Plus Tom had done TSOL I don't know if he had done DOA yet. 4 and 45.
I don't know. That might have come after. I can't remember.
That's after.
But anyhow, so that's why we redid it.
Like going back to Mystic Records, had he been putting out those? Because he did that Stickball 7-inch, he did a Helix 7-inch, he did that Aryan Disgrace single, right?
All that shit came after us. Everything. We were the first.
Whoa,
we were
the that's first. Crazy.
That's how he met Aggression, and then by meeting Aggression, he convinced them to work with him, and he got introduced to the whole Nardcore scene. And he, you know, now he claims that he created the whole Nardcore scene, but the guy's a fucking piece of shit because, well. While I will give it to him that he created a situation where all these bands could record and put records out, the fact is that he ripped them all off. He never gave anyone a statement. He just figured that if he gave bands copies of the record, that's all he needed to do.
You know where he made his money on this, on the No Effects record.
Yeah, Mike just fucking turned
and
over.
Mike's like, well, I just told him to give us 10% of the pressing, and I don't really give a shit. And I'm like, does he give it to you? He's all, actually, no.
Yeah. The guy's a fucking thief. And I've been saying it for years, and I keep telling all these bands up in Oxnard who are friends of ours, I'm all, dude, he never paid you. He doesn't own your shit. You don't have a contract. Just go and repress it. He can't do anything to you. What's he going to do? He'll threaten to sue you. He doesn't have any money to sue you. He lives in a fucking mobile home.
His library, though, the tapes he must be sitting on of, like, you know, like the NoFX stuff as well, but like the America's Hardcore stuff, the Battalions of Saints stuff. Like, there's just so much shit.
Yeah, but
those tapes are already oxidized.
You know, because that's the thing. If you have tapes, they're oxidized. You have to pay someone to bake those tapes and digitize them. I mean, that's already been done. So those tapes are probably in the trash.
Yeah. I would, I would. I hope there's some of that stuff survives somehow. But that's wild.
I don't see Doug Moody having a temperature controlled locker for his tapes.
No.
You know, and I never even thought about the fact that you guys worked with Doug Moody, but like, if it wasn't for the fact that you guys worked with him, then
he
like,
would have never been rock. Yeah. Never.
Yeah. Like, he could have gone into something else completely different. And then, like, wow, that would have been a slightly different history of punk rock without that.
He could have gone into hip hop and been even richer.
Yeah. That's true.
Well, because the guys, so right down the street was the guys that we were pressing our records with in that day, Don McMillan.
Yeah. It used to be Alco's. Alco pressing plant, and one of the guys that worked there is a Canadian, Kane Boychuk, who worked. He worked for Cargo for a little while.
Yeah.
Okay.
He worked there, and Don decided when all these rap bands started, and they were sort of following the same model of us of DIY. They would come to him to press a record that they didn't really have the money. So he pulled this sort of similar shit. I mean, he wasn't ripping anybody off as far as I know, but basically he'd say, you know what? I'll tell you what. You don't have the money to press this stuff. I'll press it. Give me a percentage. And so he sort of took control. And I mean, he didn't really know the music, but he had a few hits. And because he had a few hits, just like anybody who doesn't really know the music or understand what's going on, he started bringing in all these rappers were going, all these LA rappers were going to him. What he didn't understand is just because you sold 100,000 copies of one doesn't mean you're going to sell 100,000 copies of the next one. So he was flush with cash for a while. And I remember going down there, I'm like, holy shit, records to the ceiling. And Kane would say, yeah, man, we got this new rap thing. He's like, I don't get it. But some of the stuff I knew, and I knew that it was going to be big. Some of the stuff I'd never heard of. But, 6 months later when I went back, wow, you got a new record? He's all, no, these are returns from this one and that one. Because he pressed 100,000 thinking he was going to sell 100,000 of everything that came in. And, that didn't work out so well. So he was bankrupt within a few years. And funny enough, Epitaph ended up renting that place out. And when they started blowing up in the early 90s, they were in that space for a while.
Man, that's wild, like how – I don't know, just how much stuff happened just because of punk rock, like it's amazing.
Oh, yeah.
What it kickstarts everywhere.
I've
obviously kept you guys for a long time already. And there's like a bunch of burning questions that I have to ask you about because these are like record nerd questions, but would you guys come on for part twos separately or together again in the future? Because my God, there's so much to talk about.
Happy to.
Yeah, no problem.
But before I let you go, I got to bring this into this international thing because I think Youth Brigade doesn't really get the credit that you guys deserve as far as being a band that, I don't know, like can connect a lot of disparate different punk scenes. So how did the relationship start with AA Records, for example, like that, storied Japanese label?
That was a writing back and forth thing. I think they sent, they wrote us maybe first. I don't remember, but I was a prolific, writer, postcard and letter writer, and I would just write to people, but I think they may have written us first. I don't remember, but yeah, it was just a matter of, hey, Japanese people are very into sending me a cool picture disc and stuff like that, and they sent us stuff and they said, hey, you guys want to do something with us? And we said, sure, why not? Because we thought, hey, getting our music out to as many different places as possible is great. And I remember that Tim Yohannan was very, very upset that I had a picture disc of, shit, I can't remember the name of the band that was on AA that we had.
The Laughing Nose picture disc?
Laughing Nose, exactly.
The Pussy for Sale record.
Yeah.
It's so cool that you guys are on that label because that label puts out, like Japanese oi stuff like Cobra, but then the Zao 7-inch and like Auto and just like the top tier Japanese hardcore stuff. Were you into the records they were putting out, or was it more just to have a record in Japan?
No, I'll admit to you, man, we are not record nerds like that. I mean, it just comes across our plate, and we listen to it like, oh, this is cool, or whoa, well, this is weird.
Yeah, we had them in Japan, and then we, at Southern Studios in England doing our stuff. They did all the crafts.
Yep.
Well, we hooked up with Southern was because they were doing Discord.
Yeah.
Well,
I'm just saying, worked with some good people.
Well, yeah, no, it's, I'm going to say if AA Records did send you a box of records back then, if you held on to them, good on you because there are some pretty expensive records in their catalog now.
Held on to them and don't want them.
I'll take them.
Yeah. Send them over here if you got them, because I would love another copy of the Zao 7-inch. I spent all my birthday money on one last year and it hurt really hard.
Yeah, I have a turntable digitizer, where you can play the record and digitize it on your computer. And I've been planning for, I don't know, the last 15 years to sit down and digitize all the stuff and then just sell my record collection. But
Yeah, that never happens.
Well, I wouldn't do that.
My turntable hasn't been plugged in at least 15 years, probably longer.
Well, I think just in records that your band has put out, I could pay off, college tuition for you, because there are some records that I need from you.
I guess college tuition in Canada is much cheaper than it is in America.
Well, let us know what you don't have. We'll send you a package.
Yeah.
Oh, well, I believe me, I can't even, okay. You're going to get an email, I promise. But the next record label, like almost immediately after, you did a split with Vicious Circle, the Australian Vicious Circle on Reactor Records, another incredible label that put out a lot of great Australian hardcore. How did that relationship come about? Like, was that just once again through letter writing?
Yep, same thing. Yeah.
And we never went there. Can you believe it?
We've never been to Australia.
Really? And that's wild.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That is definitely, you got to go there at least to sign copies of the Epitaph Care split.
We just go there just to serve.
Yeah.
That's what we tell people. You want us to come to your country? As long as you pay our expenses and we can serve, we're good.
But that record was though made for a tour, right?
I mean, I think there was talk of it, but...
Yeah, there's always talk of it.
It never came
to Yeah, because together. It's all, hell yeah, we'll come. Can you pay us enough money to pay the airfare?
Yeah.
And you know, for us to do the tour? Oh, we don't have that kind of money. Well, we don't either.
Yeah. I think because it might even make reference on the lyric sheet to an upcoming tour. So
sure.
I guess, the reality of airfares must have hit pretty hard.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean... Sure, everyone's all, you guys going to come, you want to come on a tour? Hell yeah, we do. You want to send us plane tickets? Oh, we don't have that kind of money.
Especially nobody was paying for that stuff.
No, I mean, the European tour we did in 84 was because we saved up money. We basically set up a tour across the U.S., and from that tour we had enough money to go and fly to Europe.
And you guys had records come. Oh, I guess the records came out afterwards, right? Because you did. You're on that compilation that 77 KK Records did, and they put out a LP too.
Yeah, yeah. Well, but before we went to Europe, we had the Southern. We made the deal with Southern. They actually took over pressing, but I believe they had released some of them. Did they?
That was later
in the 80s. So yeah, we didn't have a. We didn't have a release there. We just brought some records with us.
Oh, did they do What Price Is What Price Happiness for that tour? Because there's a UK pressing of that, right, from 84.
Yeah, actually it might have been.
Yeah. No, they did, because I flew in, remember? We went across the country and I flew out early. And John fucked up on the date and booked our first date in London with the Subhumans the wrong day. I was there for the show. But Mark and Adam weren't coming till the next day. And I don't know. That's the beauty of letter writing, is people just don't read the letters.
Yeah. And I guess
there's... So I was there and I got to watch the Subhumans play, and I'm all, hey guys, I can't play because that's just me and I don't do solo, sorry.
What was the what kind of shows were you guys playing in Europe? Obviously the Subhumans, but like, was it mainly with sort of the peace punk stuff or the more anarcho stuff or more of the oi stuff?
It was whatever.
I mean, we did the one with UK Subs at the 100 Club.
Yeah.
And then in Europe, yeah, probably more oi bands, I think.
It was a bit of both. I mean, we played with Rappresalia in Milan. And we played with Escorbuto in Spain in Barcelona. Yeah. And,
what was that show like?
It was awesome. I mean, it was just kind of a whirlwind because we were just partying, getting fucked up, and meeting all these new people.
Yeah, what happened crazy. When we got to England was we used Peter and the Test Tube Babies' van, and it was the Rolling Stones.
No, it wasn't their van. Was it their van?
I mean, their manager helped us.
Yeah, it was basically DOA. Joey gave us a bunch of info because they just toured Europe, and they said, yeah, here's all the people that we use. This guy's cool. These people are cool. He even gave us the number for this guy in Poland and said, dude, they want bands to play. We couldn't do it. We didn't have time. And we actually played five shows.
Yeah.
Five shows in Poland.
Before,
we were the first
one. Before the wall was down.
Yeah.
So it was crazy.
That was a trip.
But the crazy thing is that we were in London, and we get the van, and they send us out with this guy to be our tour manager.
Yeah,
and we'd never been there. It's the three of us and our two roadies from another state of mind.
Yeah.
Marlon, the black guy, and Brian, the skinhead guy, who's doing the slam dance lessons.
Yeah. Yeah.
So those two big guys, right? And we get there. We do a couple shows in England, and we get over to Amsterdam, and the guy says, "Hey, did they tell you how much you're paying me?" And we said, "No." And it was like 300 quid a day. And we were like, "Yeah, see you later. There's the ferry."
We were in somebody's house. We were staying in somebody's house in Holland, and he's all, and we said, "Yeah, sorry, dude, we can't afford that." And he's all, "Can you drive me to the airport?"
No, to the ferry. And we're like, "The bus stop's right there."
He's like, "That's so pedestrian."
And so we just got a map, and we just did it in our van. That was a
right hand drive
with the Union Jack painted on the whole side of it. It was the Rolling Stones roadies van, and we're going to Eastern Bloc, like going through like East Germany,
Czechoslovakia. We played two shows in Yugoslavia.
No tour manager, just with the map. Go right, go left. The next thing you know, we're getting pulled over. We got machine guns on us. And it was crazy. Yeah.
That's awesome. So what, did you play with Deserter in Poland?
Yeah. Deserter and Xena.
Oh.
Yeah.
That hit me up, too.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Some motherfucker stole my Vox guitar in Poland. And was it in Warsaw? It was in Warsaw.
Yeah.
We were partying so crazy in the rooms we were staying in. And it's somebody who's a friend of some band, because he's like, "I still have the guitar." I'm like, "Fuck you. I want it back. I love that guitar."
Yeah.
Vox fit.
Yeah.
A lot of vodka. You couldn't even get beer after 10 a.m. in Poland.
Yeah.
So if you wanted beer, you would have to go to the store in the morning and buy it. Because
stand in line.
So by noon, there everywhere. Was nothing left in the stores.
Yeah.
So you'd have to buy the beer and just have, like, you know, bags of beer. And so at night, there would just be vodka. And it's just like, "Yeah, you're Canadian. You could drink with us."
Yeah.
Which we did.
Yeah.
That's amazing too, because like every city you're going to, you're playing with like the hardcore band, it sounds like, from that area. Well, at least from like someone not from there that I know of from those areas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What a tour.
But I don't remember any bands that we played with in Germany, do you?
I think we played with BGK in Holland.
In Holland we did, yeah. We did play with BGK.
But Toxic did we Class, maybe? Maybe?
Maybe we played with Upright Citizens, though.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Upright Citizens, we did a couple shows with.
Because you got to do a record for him later on.
Yeah, you know David Pollack? You know Destiny in Berlin?
I don't know if I know that, actually.
So what was his first band?
Man, I can't remember the name of it, but he was our promoter on that tour.
Oh, Destiny Records. Sorry. Yeah, absolutely.
Destiny Tour Booking. He does
he had the booking well before he ever had the label.
Yeah.
They did that compilation that you guys are on, too, I think.
Yeah, he did. He didn't ask us.
I guess the other thing that I wanted to add, one of the first Youth Brigade records I actually ever got, like, on vinyl, was that weird flexi that came out with a British fanzine that I found in a used record store in Toronto that you did with 7 Seconds.
Oh, yeah. What was on it? Sync with California and...
And they do Colorblind on their side.
Oh, Colorblind.
Colorblind, yeah. That's a great song.
Did you guys press that, or is that a Southern thing that I guess Southern would have done because it's a British fanzine?
I think it was the fanzines thing. It was a freebie, you know?
No, it's absolutely, that was, I remember getting it as a kid, finding that thing, and it was like a Rosetta Stone for me. And I guess another thing I want to ask you about, a weird thing, when I bought the Aggression album as a young person, I opened it up and inside there was a newsletter, a BYO newsletter, but it was written by Pusshead, Brian Schroeder.
Yeah. Well, he didn't write the whole newsletter. So Pusshead did the logo for BYO.
Yeah.
He also did the cover art for Someone Got Their Head Kicked In. So probably what was on that newsletter was his explanation of what the logo was. But I wrote all the stuff for the newsletters. And then our brother Adam did some of the graphics early on. But the shit that we probably put in that was... sort of, that was him explaining the logo and how, you know, the vision and this and what, and that logo was really something that was not like any of the other shit that he did. Most of the shit he did was weird, horror, fucked up stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. It was crazy. But so it wasn't like they were you know, doing something with the label other than he just did the logo type thing?
Yeah, I mean, we helped him put out his Septic Depth. Like, we helped him put out his own record. We didn't put it out, but I hooked him up with the pressing plant and all that and told him how to do it. But we didn't want to put it out because it was just not our thing, you know. I didn't think I could sell it. And it wasn't something. We mostly put out stuff that we really like and think we can help the band. And I just, you know, I like Pusshead and I get what he was doing, but it's just not our thing.
Absolutely. But it's still, like, amazing, once again, like, another kind of, like, realm of punk that you guys just kind of, like, bump into.
Yeah, I mean, in those days it was a very small scene, so everybody kind of knew everybody or everybody met everybody, and, you know, that's, you know, we were friends with all the Discord guys, we were friends with the Boston people.
Plus it was before everybody blew up, you know.
Yeah.
Nobody was popular back then.
Every city had this little scene, you know, maybe it was 50 people, maybe it was 500 people, whatever it was, I mean, but we were all growing together, but it was like what Mark was saying earlier about how after that initial sort of 77 punk rock scene that started New York, London, and then the LA scene, when it blew up in LA, LA's been the biggest punk rock scene in the world ever since then, since the early 80s. You know, nowhere you could go where a good punk show will draw 5,000 people pretty easily in LA, and now it can be more like 10,000.
20.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Even 20 if it's a good enough bill. Mm-hmm. You don't find that really anywhere else. That's not going to happen in London. It's not going to happen in New York.
Yeah, no, definitely. It feels like, you know, just the names that were rhyming off here, be it like Matt Groening or No Crisis. It's just like amazing all the kind of levels of culture that are coming out of that punk scene.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy.
Before I let you go, last question type thing. What was it with the Winnipeg scene? Because you guys did do so many records from bands from that city. What do you think it was about that city that produced so many cool bands and made you want to put it on records by them?
Well, it did too, Unwanted and Stretch Marks, and then we had SNFU, which was Edmonton. Just that when we were on tour on that Another State of Mind tour, first of all, we met a ton of cool people, and we always felt this sort of, you know, kinship because we're Canadian and we like the bands, and like I said, we put out stuff that we like and we think we can help the bands. And there were so many cool bands and nice people that we just wanted to help them out. And I mean, look, SNFU, fuck.
Yeah.
They're one of our
They were just an opener on our show, and we were there, and I don't even know if we hadn't heard them yet.
No.
And they just hit the stage and we were like, holy shit, these guys are amazing.
Yeah, that was on our first, was on the second tour after Another State of
Mind. Right, and that's how we ended up signing them. We were like, hey, you know, we'll put your record out because we knew how to put records out. So,
yeah.
But I always felt like Western Canadian bands were powerful. They just had the best musicians.
Yeah.
There was a whole sound there, you know, from DOA, Personality Crisis. I mean, the musicianship was insane.
Yeah.
It always was like that.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I guess, like, you know, because you did play all these scenes and got to play with all these bands, like, what to you is like a band that kind of fell through the cracks that you don't think kind of gets talked about that you saw, like being on that Another State of Mind tour or some of the later tours or even on that European tour?
So many. I don't even know where to begin. I'll tell you one, though. I'll tell you one that when we were still in the extremes, the Mass closed down and Brendan opened another called the New Mass. It didn't last more than, I don't even think it lasted a year, maybe in 8 months, but I remember the Dead Boys played. And this band that opened up for them, and I mean, at that point, this was probably 79, so I don't even know if the Bad Brains existed, but if they did, we'd never heard of them. This band called Pure Hell.
Oh, opened. Yeah.
Yeah, and no one really knew who the hell they were, and we just heard, oh, this band Pure Hell from Philly, and they came out. I think they were a three-piece. And the fucking singer was doing handstands on stage. They fucking blew us away. So that's a band that, you know, what the hell? They were amazing. They came and they were gone. I don't even know if they even put out a record or anything.
There's one 7-inch, and then there's a CD that kind of has some live tracks on it, but definitely one of the most obscure bands ever. That's so crazy. I can't believe they made it out to LA to play shows, too.
Yeah. I couldn't either. We didn't know anything about them. But Brendan, you know, Brendan was the shit. Brendan knew. Brendan found out about a lot of bands. But that's the sad thing, and we talk about it a bit in our movie and in the book, that we just feel that LA just doesn't get
the recognition that it deserves. But whatever. I mean, you know, we get the same thing for the people like to talk shit about LA, but LA, this is a great city, and that so much great music has come out of here. And when it comes to the punk scene, you know, when people do these retrospectives like that punk thing on Epics that they just made, and no doubt the Stooges and Iggy, they're the kings, you know, and there's great bands out of New York and there's great bands out of London. But look, this scene, punk rock's been going on now for what, 35, 40 years? Mm-hmm. Even longer if you want to go all the way back to the late 60s with the Stooges and stuff. But the majority of its longevity is because of the LA punk rock scene and what's gone on here. I mean, from the late 70s all the way through now, there are so many bands here that are classic bands that people know about all over the world. And, you know, it's just kind of a shame when people do these retrospectives and they don't recognize what's gone on here and how crucial are, you know, all these bands' contribution has been.
Yeah,
look, but that's okay.
No, they never talk about Zolar X. They never talk about the Screamers. Zolar X.
Did you just say Zolar X?
I love that Zolar X 12-inch.
Yeah, but see, Zolar X was kind of in the early metal scene. They were a weird band, man.
Did you ever see them live?
Yeah.
Oh, that's
there was a club. They were around when Van Halen was starting out. Van Halen would open for them.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah, they would play Gazzari's. And then there was that club for a minute. Was it the Cabaret down where the Beverly Center eventually came up? Remember? Yeah, I think it was the Cabaret. It was a goth dance club after a while. But they were doing some metal shows down there for a minute. And I'm pretty sure Zolar X. Yeah, Zolar X was definitely, they were quite the show.
Oh, this is so awesome. Thank you both so much for coming on the show. And please know
No problem. Thanks for having us.
The door is always open. Always open.
All right. We'll talk again sometime soon. And definitely we're looking forward to seeing you in 3 weeks, basically.
Oh, man.
That's going to be fun.
I got to get to work.
You better book all those bands, Mark. Jeez.
Thank you, Mark and Sean, for coming on the show. And you can hear right there, there's room for part two, part three, part four. We didn't even talk about Another State of Mind, so they will be back in the future for more. I promise you that. And also, I can promise you something else. We're going to have an episode dropping tomorrow. That's right. More on that in 1 second. But before I talk about that, remember, Punk Rock Bowling is coming up next weekend in Las Vegas. There's tons of other shows and events going on around it, including an incredible official wrestling after party with Turned Out of Punk friend, I guess, official wrestler of sorts, one Mr. Darby Allin Wrestling, also friend, official wrestler of the podcast as well. Matt Cross will be wrestling on all that. Suburban Fights putting that on. We'll have more information about that next week. But Punk Rock Bowling is in Las Vegas next weekend. It's going to be incredible. If you don't have plans, come on out. You know, how could you not want to see all these incredible bands that are going to be playing on that thing? Also, next week on the 22nd Wednesday, The Wrestlers, the TV show that I myself and my buddies Jeff and Nathan and Yuji and Grady and Sarah and so many of a call, and all of us poured so much love and heart and soul into this show, and it's finally debuting with an episode featuring one Mr. Darby Allin. It's going to be debuting next Wednesday on Viceland, 10 p.m. Eastern time, I believe worldwide, 10 p.m. Well, not worldwide, in America. It's going to be coming out in other places soon. I'll have more details on that in the near future, but it's going to be coming out next week on Wednesday. And then right actually the day after, I'm going to be going and doing a podcast with my buddies, John Pollock and Wei Ting, talking about the episode and kind of digging deep and telling what happened to the characters afterwards. And, you know, it's going to be a fun podcast. I'm going to be doing that with those guys. They also have a brand new documentary dropping themselves, a podcast documentary about the last day of Owen Hart. So if you're a wrestling fan, check out Post Wrestling. Check out Post Wrestling for the Wrestlers After Show, but check it out for that documentary as well. They do great work. Shout out to those guys. I owe those guys a lot. They, you know, you listen to this podcast, you know, I give those guys credit for really being key influences on me starting this podcast. So you know, gotta love that wrestling podcast. Okay, I'm delaying it. Coming up tomorrow on Turned Out of Punk, it's gonna be dropping tomorrow night about midnight as well. So heading into your Friday, you're gonna have a chance to listen to this thing. Milo from The Descendants is coming on the show. Shout out to Vanessa for setting this up. Yep, that's all you need to say. Milo, the legend, the vocalist, is coming on the show, and it is a doozy of an episode. There's a lot of stuff that I had no idea about. Maybe you know some of the stuff. I didn't know all the stuff, that's for sure. We talk about some cool things. Milo is awesome. I love hanging out with this guy, and so the chance to punish him, that's why I do this thing, you know? It's one thing to get to hang out with someone. It's another thing to force them to answer your questions for an hour. You know, that's how you know you've picked the right thing to do with your life, a podcast, when you get to punish people like that. All right, I'm going to leave you to the punishment of doing without this podcast till tomorrow. Thank you once again to Vanessa for today. Thank you to Mark and Sean. Thank you to Vanessa for setting up tomorrow as well. Thank you to Tristan. Thank you to you. Go out there and make your own culture. Tell all your friends about this podcast. Sign your organ donor cards. I'll see you next week. I will see you next week. We got a big week next week too. Well, I'll see you tomorrow. What am I talking about next week? I'll see you tomorrow. Tomorrow on Turned Out of Punk. Woo! Wrestlers, next week, May 22nd.